Welcome back to the Symphonies of Beethoven. This is Lecture 29, the second of five lectures dealing with Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 in D minor, Opus 125, a group of lectures that I have entitled, as a group, The Symphony as the World. We return to the first movement. We have been talking about the protagonists in this gigantic musical drama, which are key areas, more than contrasting themes. It is key areas that duke it out here in the first movement. And the main key areas of this first movement are D minor, the key area of angst and universal despair, and B flat major, the key area of the good fight, of struggle, of heroism. And we have heard theme one uttered in both D minor monumentally and darkly, and in B flat major, magnificently and powerfully. And these protagonists, these fighters, these duelists are going to try to determine the future of this movement based on these different key areas and the moods they imbue the themes with. Before we move on, we must talk about the essential motives of theme one. Again, I would remind you all, a motive is a brief succession of pitches that is manipulated in such a way as to create a longer melodic idea, a theme. And there are three essential motives I want us to be aware of in theme one. The first of these motives is the descending D minor arpeggio that is theme one, itself a cumulative aspect of the introduction. That is, as the fifths and fourths of the intro accumulated, there was more and more notes that, when we put them all together, create an essential D minor arpeggio. And that's that descending arpeggio. We've talked about this almost to the point of agony, the fact that Beethoven's first themes, usually in his fast movements, are what we call triadic. They outline a basic harmonic unit called a triad that is usually the tonic triad, that is the basic harmony of that particular movement. And by having a theme that outlines the tonic triad, we have an unequivocal statement of key area, not just harmonically, but now also melodically. So the first motive with which we must be intimately familiar with is this descending arpeggiated motive, consisting as it does of short and long rhythms. We will hear it all over the place. Motive number two is a motive that I will refer to as the theme one motive, or perhaps theme one phrase A motive. It's the melodic idea that follows immediately on the heels of that descending arpeggio. It sounds like this. Again. One more time. How many times have we talked about during the course of these lectures that Beethoven's ideas are often so banal that they seem impossible to deal with? How can he construct anything out of an idea so simple and seemingly obvious? Yet an unbelievable amount of musical mileage will be generated from ya-bam-bam-bam, three short rhythms followed by an upwards leap and a more sustained pitch. Ya-bam-bam-bam, and for those who are viewing, I've illustrated that motive on the board underneath the descending arpeggio motive. The last motive with which we must be familiar is the exclamatory fanfare motive. Bum, ba-bum, bum. Bum, ba-bum, bum. And it will be used as an exclamation mark, as a punctuation mark, as a very dramatic and often dark and sometimes light idea, but always very loud and very powerfully intoned. So again, the descending arpeggio that characterizes theme one, that theme one motive consisting of three short and one longer note higher than the three short ones, and this fanfare rhythm. They are the essential three motives with which I want us to be familiar. Now let's listen to theme one again as it occurred in D minor from measures 17 through 25, phrases A and B, finishing with that incredible contraction and collapse that occurs before the reintroduction. And I will point out when these motives appear just so that we can hear them in context. Theme one, D minor. Arpeggio. Theme one motive. Thank you. Exclamatory fanfare. Bum, ba, bum, bum. Again, bum, ba, bum, bum. All right, good. We should be conversant now with those motives, and we can follow them and recognize them, hopefully, when they spring up, and spring up they shall. Back to theme one as it appeared in B-flat major, starting at measure 51. I read again from your word scores, and this time through the modulating bridge. Measure 51, theme one in B-flat major. The formerly ferocious and tragic nature of the theme becomes heroic and magnificent in B-flat major, but I would point out, not for long, my friends, not for long. D major encroaches quickly at measure 55, a terse statement built upon the theme one motive. Bum, 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 bum. Same idea we talked about apropos of the motives. A terse statement built on the motive, yah, bah, bah, bum, alternates between strings and winds and drags the tonality back to the dark side of D minor, and then ensues the modulating bridge at measure 63. The sense of opposing polarities is physically reinforced by a bridge theme in contrary motion, which clearly pits soprano instruments against bass instruments. Yeah, I would just illustrate this again at the piano. It's easier to hear these sometimes, not orchestrally, but on the more intimate and colorless piano. I just want you to notice that these two lines, top and bottom, are moving in exact contrary motion against each other. Again. And so we have an almost physical representation of the kind of polar, contrary material that we're talking about apropos of key area here represented melodically. Let's listen to theme one. At measure 51, first heroically and magnificently in B-flat major, but quickly a transition to D minor via that theme one motive, ya-ba-bum-bum, and then the modulating bridge characterized by these polar contrary motion lines in soprano and bass. Theme one. Measure 55. Modulating bridge. And this delivers us to theme group two. And I'm calling it a theme group because there's so much thematic material here, I can't just call it a single theme. There's too many diverse parts to this theme, so I'm calling it a theme group. What ties them all together, all these diverse parts, however, is that they have in common the key of B-flat major. We're no longer in D minor, but we're not in the textbook key either of F major, which is where we might have expected Beethoven to go if he cared about the rules. Beethoven stopped caring about the rules about 21 years ago, so we shouldn't expect him to worry a whole heck of a lot about where he's going to go tonally, besides which it makes sense to go to B-flat major. This is the key of the heroic polarity, and theme two, or theme two group, lives within that heroic, or at least that more positive, expressive world. All right, from your word scores. Phrase A, a smooth lyric melody will become the ode to joy theme in the fourth movement. And I would illustrate that. Here is phrase A of theme two. Now, it doesn't take a whole leap of imagination to hear how that turns into the ode to joy. Again, phrase A becomes Let's listen, please, to phrase A, theme 2. We're going to do this phrase by phrase, by the way. It's essential that we become familiar with each of these phrases because every melodic chunk we hear either has developed from something that we've heard earlier or will be used as a point of departure for further development. So unless we know all of these characters, and usually in a Beethoven first movement, there's two main characters, theme one and theme two, except, of course, in the first movement of the Third Symphony, there was themes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And that's one reason why that movement took a long time. Well, indeed, the same is true in this movement. There are many subsidiary characters. The main character, of course, is D minor and B flat major. Those are our main characters. But within that, there are many motives with which we must be familiar. So please let us continue. Phrase B of theme 2. The winds play a passage which is itself a development of elements of A. That passage sounds like this. And so forth. Oh, sure, I'll show you how that's a development of A. Why not? A went like this. From downbeat to downbeat, A did this. Well, so does B. B also spans from downbeat to downbeat the distance of three notes, as did A. Beethoven simply filling in what we call the distance of a third with different melodic material. But suffice to say, if that wasn't clear, and I have the sensibility that it wasn't terribly clear, suffice to say that phrase B is a new version of the same intervallic material in phrase A. That sounds very fancy, and it is accurate, if not terribly clear. Let's listen, please, to phrase B. Oh, by the way, notice the skittish staccato strings in the accompaniment underneath this new phrase B. Brief wind interlude. Phrase C, rising and falling 16th note scales in contrary motion. Now that should sound familiar. Didn't the modulating bridge do just that? Excuse me. Indeed, that's exactly what the modulating bridge did. Scales in contrary motion. Well, the same thing happens in phrase C, but they're faster. They're 16th notes. They are a diminution, an intensification of the rhythms we heard in the modulating bridge. Harmonic tension and rhythmic energy build. And again, we're still in the key of B flat major. Let's listen to phrase C of theme 2. Now, I would point out something that might be getting obvious at this point. Theme 2 consists of a series of small ideas, all of them interrelated with something else. Phrase A of theme 2 will grow to become the Ode to Joy theme in the fourth movement. Phrase B is based on the phrase A theme. Phrase C is based on the modulating bridge. All kinds of subtle but definite relationships spinning a web of memory and unity across the beginnings of this piece. Let's just be aware of that. This fragmented second theme group is in many ways small relationships going in different directions, forward to later movements and backwards to earlier events within this movement. Lastly, the remainder of theme 2 group at measure 102. Forceful exclamatory fanfares bring the theme 2 group to a sudden and climactic halt. Yum bum ba bum, yum bum ba bum. A brief wind interlude drawn from A. Ya di da dum bum. Another forceful exclamatory fanfare. Yum bum ba bum. bum, bum, ba, bum, and then another brief interlude. This one suddenly directs the harmony far from B-flat to B major, followed by a string descent. Please, the conclusion of theme group 2, starting at measure 102, these forceful exclamatory fanfares. And I would point out that theme group 2 ends with dynamic polarities, from very loud to very soft, back to back. This is a game that Beethoven has played before in his cadence material, but in this particular piece, it has specific thematic relevance. That is, we're hearing juxtaposed very unlike ideas, forceful fanfares juxtaposed with these lyric and quiet and frankly wimpy but delightful interludes, back and forth, back and forth. It's slightly schizophrenic music, and I want us to hear it that way, and good performance should bring out the irregularities of these contrasts, these great contrasts. All right, let's listen to all of Theme 2 Group now as it was composed and as it was meant to be heard in succession, starting with phrase A. B. Wind interlude. C. Exclamatory fanfares. Again. Measure 108. And an interesting comparison between themes 1 and 2 is wanting. Theme 1 is monumental and coherent. Theme 2 is filled with changing character, flux. It's almost developmental in its small interrelated phrases. All right, onwards to the cadence material in 6 parts. We are now amply prepared to follow the materials built on the motives of themes 1 and 2, and that's why we've spent so much darn time studying those themes. I would read the word score. Cadence material. Part 1. Brief serpentine sequences create an air of mystery and anticipation. By the way, Beethoven did the same thing, if you recall, in the cadence material of the Eighth Symphony, First Movement. He began that cadence material with a long, many-octave ascent on a diminished chord. And here, 12 years later, he still has it in his mind to begin his cadence material with a mysterious and ambiguous harmonic idea, because we're not quite sure what key we're in here. Part 2, a sequence based on the theme 1 motive, ba-ba-ba-bum. Note timpani accompany with the exclamatory fanfare rhythm, bum-bum-ba-bum. Part 3, brilliant, almost triumphant sequence features vigorous falling, rising 16th note scales drawn from theme 2, phrase C. Part 4, sequence pits thoroughly outgunned winds in alternation with exclamatory fanfare chords. Again, this alpha-omega kind of thing, these light lyric winds cannot fight these fanfares, and there's a sense of confrontation, of at least dynamic polarity in phrases like that. Part 5, suddenly bold winds take on exclamatory-like rhythm. The entire orchestra joins in, converging into Part 6, massive ascending, descending B-flat major arpeggio in the exclamatory fanfare rhythm, but of course sounding even more like the opening D minor arpeggio that began Theme 1. In orchestral unison, note, this counters the huge D minor descending arpeggio of Theme 1, fortissimo B-flat major. So when we end the exposition, we end it as we began with Theme 1, but of course we are in B-flat major, a heroic and magnificent key, as opposed to D minor, a terrifying and magnificent key. So, cadence material, parts 1 through 6. Please, this is almost a development section unto itself. What I want you to be most aware of are the juxtapositions of unlike musical material, loud versus soft. One phrase immediately gives way to another seemingly unrelated phrase, but we know that in Beethoven all is related, at least under the surface. But on the surface, jagged juxtapositions of polar, different sounding music. Here we go. Cadence material, part 1. Part 2. Part 3. Part 4. Part 5. Part 6. There is no exposition repeat in this movement. Beethoven does not ask for the exposition to be repeated, and thank goodness he does not. The scale of this movement really will not permit it. It's long enough as it is, and he must move on with his material to the development, so we shall also. Development section. It is a huge development section. Not since the Third Symphony have we seen a development section of this scope and this length, and in terms of dramatic contrast, we have not seen such a development since the Third Symphony. In 12 parts, filled with polar juxtapositions, constant change, emotional expressive disruption, ebbing and flowing energy. Now, as usual, time precludes us from doing the kind of part-by-part examination this music begs for, so instead, I will divide this development into two. And we will listen to it in two large parts. First, parts 1 through 7, and then parts 8 through 12. So from your word scores, parts 1 through 7. All right, part 1, the open fifth AE of the opening returns, sounding at first like an exposition repeat. Measure 170, after 10 measures, the harmony changes. This is clearly now not the exposition, though harmonic change occurs very slowly. Harmonies begin to change more rapidly as descending motives appear with increasing frequency. Part 2, dramatic dissonant version of the massive ascending, descending Theme 1 arpeggio heard at the end of the exposition, an orchestral unison on an F-sharp diminished 7 chord. I should tell you a little bit about these diminished 7 chords. The most dissonant chord in Beethoven's harmonic universe is what we call a diminished 7 chord. An F-sharp diminished 7 chord sounds like this. Again, I would redefine dissonance for you. A dissonance is an unstable harmony that must resolve. It's not an ugly harmony, because that is a subjective definition of dissonance, and we have no room for that. It simply means this is unstable, and it's got to go somewhere. What makes a diminished 7 chord so neat and so exciting and so unbelievably dissonant is that that chord could resolve to any one of 4 different keys. It could resolve to G minor, which is what it will do in this particular passage, but it could also resolve to B flat minor, or it can also resolve to E minor, or it can also resolve to D flat or C sharp minor. These diminished seventh chords are like musical olive oil. They'll grease any harmonic sequence you put them in. So they are extremely unstable, and they can go in many different directions. As it is in part two, a dramatic dissonant version of the massive ascending, descending theme one arpeggio heard based on this very dissonant harmony. Part three, suddenly forlorn figure in the winds based on the dum, bum, 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 theme one motive. The momentum of the music falters momentarily. Yes, we've gone from this ferocious dissonance, very loud, to this almost pathetic motive, piano in G minor. Part four, plaintive, tired-sounding version of theme one reveals an entirely new facet of this formerly tragic or heroic theme. Part five, another dramatic dissonant version of the ascending, descending theme one arpeggio, this one rising and falling on a B diminished seventh chord. That's a lot of dissonance, my friends. And part six, again, the forlorn figure based on dum, bum, 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 motive from theme one brings the music to a near standstill. And no wonder when we observe the musical rapids that lie just ahead. Yes, we are at midpoint of the development section, and what is there but a fugue, a dramatic and turbulent fugue. This fugue evokes a mood of heroic struggle. The subject grows directly out of our theme one motive. There's the beginning of the fugue subject. As more and more voices come in, there's a sense of turmoil, a sense of struggle, a sense of duel, a sense of protagonists fighting it out with each other, each melody trying to assert its supremacy over the others. It's a wonderful and dramatic midpoint. Let's listen to parts 1 through 7 of the development. Part 4. Part 5. Part 6. Thank you. Now, I would point out that that fugue doesn't piddle out. It doesn't kind of get quieter and less complicated. Beethoven doesn't congeal the different polyphonic parts into massive harmonies, something he is wont to do, and we've seen it a lot in other pieces. No, it just stops, and we begin part eight. Again, juxtapositions, strange polarities up next to each other. Part eight, the heroic energy of the fugue dissipates, melting into a quiet dialogue of dum, bum, 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 motives heard over staccato 16th notes. Part 9, cantabile, singingly, in a lyric passage of great pathos. The theme 1 motive, again, dum, bum, 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 is sequenced over a slower moving, low string accompaniment. At 267, a brief, bright flurry in the winds acts like a ray of sunshine in this otherwise melancholy passage. At 271, a return to the theme 1 motive, bum, 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 heard over a pedal E. Part 10, pensive melancholy version of phrase B from theme 2. Part 11 brings back the cantabile type music heard in part 9, imitations of the theme 1 motive over eighth note cello accompaniment. Now, note. The key of F major is comfortably established here in part 11. F major, a very positive key, not a dark and despairing one, imbuing this music with a sweetness and calm new to the development until, of course, a C sharp comes out of the bass. Yes, we had been on a C7 harmony, the dominant harmony, the 5 of F major, and everything seemed hunky-dory. But if I change the bass note from the C natural that it is now to a C sharp, we now have a C sharp diminished 7 chord, one of those huge dissonances. And where does that C sharp diminished 7 chord want to resolve? To D minor, the key of angst and despair. And when that C sharp appears in the bass, oh boy, time to head for the exits, folks, or you're going to buy it big time. Indeed, part 12, huge orchestral unison descent of 3 octaves outlines the diminished 7 chord of D minor. The effect is extraordinary, as if the music is spiraling downwards into some sort of hideous harmonic black hole. Oh, I want you to hear that. I want you to feel that. Let's listen, please, to the development, parts 8 through 12. You will suffer one of the great cutoffs of all time because this music will stop just before it hits bottom. But there's something to be gleaned from that that will be positive, so indulge me, please. Development, parts 8 through 12. Part 9. Part 10. Part 11, listen for the C sharp. Now, part 12. Believe me, you don't want to get there too fast. It's just as well we take a little time to get there. All right, let's talk about where we're going, because it's not where we thought we were going. Recapitulation, a moment to live for, a moment to die for. Recapitulation, introduction. Incredible, fantastic. To our eternal and supreme surprise, we land on a D major chord, not the expected D minor. Note, the tonally ambiguous open fifth of the opening of the movement is brilliantly exploited here, as the presence of a major third, a color tone, had always been possible, but not anticipated. Remember in the introduction, we just had an open fifth, and I said it lacks a C or a C sharp that would have made that A and E a major or a minor triad. It always could have been major. It's just that the theme that followed it was minor, so we assume that the introduction was always minor. But maybe the introduction at some basic primal level was always major. That's what Beethoven's exploiting here, and it's a moment of extraordinary import. Meanwhile, underneath it all, ferocious, teeth-rattling timpani roll blares forth, I mean, just absolutely rocks the entire concert hall. What follows is a soul-shattering, spectacular, riveting, earth-shaking version of the introduction in Tutti. Anthony Hopkins wrote, awe-inspiring in the same way that a vision of the avenging angel would be. One's eyes would be dazzled by his radiance, even though one's heart would quake with terror. This is an amazing D chord in what we call first inversion, vicious, but magnificent, powerful, and brilliant at the same time. And suddenly, D major gives away to D minor. Theme one, abbreviated, tragic, despairing, heart-rending version of the theme, accompanied by vicious brass fanfares and a new countermelody in the bass. So as quickly as major was there, it's gone, replaced by the darkness of D minor. And by the way, D major is not a key we've had a lot of up to now, but we're going to end the symphony in D major, so we should know that this appearance of D major signals important things to come. I said that theme one in the recap here, which, by the way, that teeth-rattling timpani roll continues at this moment. I said that theme one is abbreviated. Indeed, we have no phrase B, and neither do we even have a modulating bridge. In their place, at measure 327, the brief descent that had preceded phrase B in the exposition is here extended into a long, initially violent sequence. All right, here's what we're going to listen to. Back to the development, back to part 11, which begins, if you recall, in F major, and everything seems kind of nice. Suddenly that C sharp slips into the bass, which spirals us downwards in part 12, seemingly to the depths, to the abyss, to the bottom of our musical barrel, only to hit bottom on that D major chord. An amazing moment, but a very terrifying moment nevertheless, which leads inevitably to theme one in D minor. But now we know that there's an even more bold juxtaposition, a more bold polarity than even B flat and D minor, and that is D major and D minor, heard side by side in the recapitulation. Development, part 11. C sharp. Part 12. One in D minor. And we move directly into theme two in the key of D major. Let's go to the coda, please, in 10 parts, because as all of the codas are in Beethoven's most expansive and expressive symphonies, they amount to second development sections. Emphasizes the darker, more tragic polarity of the movement. Parts 1 through 3. Part 1, sudden, quiet, almost pathetic version of the theme, stripped of its energy and machismo. Part 2, theme 2C, our contrary motion phrase, is heard fortissimo and then piano. Part 3, Theme 1, Phrase B, blaring exclamatory fanfares, sequence upwards. We had not heard Phrase B in the recapitulation, so Beethoven's giving it to us instead here in the coda. Coda, Parts 1 through 3, from the pathetic to the blaring. Part 3. Coda, Parts 4 through 7. And indeed, just as the music turned off just now, did you feel that glimmer of hope, that sense of brightness? Well, we're going to hear it big time. A glimmer of hope, quiet Theme 1 motives, yum, bum, 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 appear in winds and horns over an A pedal, a sustained A in the bass, but we're hearing the key of D major. D major. Isn't that the key that went up against D minor in the recapitulation? Wasn't that that masked stranger that seemed to come out of nowhere and give us hope? Yes, it was. And it's back for a moment, but not long. Part 5, no hope here. The momentary brightness is extinguished as the harmony, with flute in the lead, moves back to D minor. Syncopations disrupt the beat and emphasize harmonic dissonance. Part 6, Theme 2, C, again the falling, rising 16th note scales tear forth. And Part 7, suddenly pathetic, almost cringing Theme 1 motives, bom, 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 in winds and strings. Their despair is understandable when we observe what comes next. Let's listen to these four parts, and then we will have to take a break and all find out what comes next in our next lecture. But Coda, Parts 4 through 7. D major. Part 5, D minor. Part 6. Part 7. And another one of those terrible cutoffs, and an even worse cutoff. This is where we must pause between our lectures. In an ideal world, we would finish the first movement, but actually it's even more ideal this way, because since the first movement segues so effortlessly into the second movement, we will get to hear the conclusion of this coda and, of course, our examination of the second movement to follow, and we will even more clearly then hear the connection between this dark, despairing ending in D minor and an equally violent, despairing beginning of the second movement, also in D minor. But I get ahead of myself when we return the remainder of the coda. Thank you.